Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Beyond the Cover, hosted by myself, John Robb, and Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how you doing tonight, my man?
Doing great. Happy Monday to you.
Happy. Well, people always say that, and they're like, "Hey, Happy Monday," and I'm like, "Nah, it's just Monday." Is there ever a happy Monday? I don't know if you can put those two words together, but
if you have a day off, maybe.
That's true. If it's Memorial Day, it's a happy Monday.
Yeah.
Which is coming up, and that's the next holiday we'll have. But tonight we have a little bit different show. We've done this before. We're bringing it back. We've done some interviews off the air for some people because we are on at 7:30 Pacific time. And for people on the East Coast, that's a little bit too late for them. So we got a couple interviews. One I did myself with author Steve Barry to talk about his latest book, The 14th Colony. I called it 10 Questions with Steve Barry. And then Jeff and I just did an interview, which we were supposed to have last week, but we had to cancel that, and we ended up getting Meg Ruhle outside of the show, so we interviewed her, and we're going to play that interview first. And then at the end of the Meg interview, we're just going to run Steve's interview, and then Jeff and I will come back on at the end of the show and talk to you about next week's show, which is what we've been gearing up for quite some time, Star Wars versus Star Trek, where Jeff will lose and I will win. But we have two fabulous guests. Jeff, tell them who they are.
Well, I was going to say, first of all, it's interesting how delusional you are. But second of all, for Star Wars, we have the author of the book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. His name is Chris Taylor. And for Star Trek, we have author Greg Cox, who has written several Star Trek novels, and he's also even featured in a interview that you can find on the Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan Blu-ray and DVD.
Awesome. Well, two shows or two universes enter. One goes in the black hole, and one survives, and that will be next week on May 2nd. So we'll get into a little bit more of that after the interview. So you ready to go, Jeff?
It sounds great.
All right, so here we go. This is Meg Ruhle. She is a literary agent. Jeff, who's some of her clients?
Lisa Gardner, Tess Gerritsen.
Enough said right there, right?
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, that's it. So for people who are looking to maybe want to be published, want to know about an agent, what an agent does in today's day and age and everything, Meg's going to tell you, because with Lisa Gardner and Tess Gerritsen as her clients, there's not much way to go but up there. And then, of course, then we will have Steve Barry on after that. So here we go. Let's hit the interview with Meg Ruhle, literary agent giant. I'm going to add that afterwards. So here we go.
Well, hey, welcome to Beyond the Cover. Usually John does the intros today, but I get the thrill and pleasure of introducing literary agent Meg Ruhle of the Jane Rotrosen Agency. I always mix that up. Meg represents some really amazing authors, including Tess Gerritsen, Lisa Gardner, and Robert Dagoni. Meg, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Jeff. I was just trying to remember the first time we met, and I think it was at Thriller Fest.
It might have been PWA.
Oh, that's right. That's right. In Seattle, a long time ago. And then subsequently at Thriller Fest every year.
Yes, that's true, and I always look forward to seeing you. It's wonderful.
Thanks.
And for some reason, we've done some pitches and pitch fests. We probably came close to the same room, maybe, and we just never connected, but I have no idea. Who knows? There's so many people in that time. They all kind of run together.
and there's a lot of running, especially after the pitch fest is over, but I'm digressing.
Which you normally do.
So, Meg, thanks again for doing this. For a lot of our listeners who do not understand the world of publishing, could you tell us exactly what is a literary agent, and what is your daily routine?
Oh, that's a great question, and I think that probably every literary agent would have a different way of answering it. But to the last part, one of the things I love about my job is that I don't have literally a daily routine. Every day is different, and one of the most enjoyable aspects of working as an agent is that you're involved with every part of the publishing process, as compared with perhaps working in a publishing house where you might have specific responsibilities in marketing or editorial or publicity or rights. Not that there isn't crossover in a publishing house, but for me, there's a blend of all of those things every day, as well as engaging with the authors I work with as a sounding board, helping both solo and with other members of our team in helping an author who wants developmental input on a work, meetings all day long with people from very diverse, parts of the publishing world, the movie piece of it, the television piece, scouts who are scouting for properties both for, overseas and perhaps for movie producers too. So I'm going on and on now, but the thing that I really like about it is there is no routine, which really suits me. To the first part of your question, Jeff, what is a literary agent? What does an agent do? Really simply, I always say an agent is a business partner to an author.
Now, and
I like that.
And that's something that's very interesting, because in today's day and age, of course, now that you can self-publish and people can put their stuff up, and I call it the American Idol syndrome, as my mom thinks I'm a great writer, so why can't I just, I'm going to publish my own book and people are going to read it and I'm going to be famous. Why should people in today's day and age still get an agent?
Well, again, a really good question, and I've always said not everyone does need to get an agent or want to get an agent. So I think that, with the channels of opportunity that exist now for publishing, that question is even more valid than it used to be. And I think that, for me, all of the opportunities that are out there for writers are exciting, because the barriers to entry, I think, are much less formidable for writers. And I think that that has to be a good thing. So why would one person choose to hire an agent and another not? And I think, for some people, there is a comfort level and an enjoyment and a mastery of the business aspects. For others, I think the agent, basically in handling the business parts, first of all, saves an author time. And that's usually time that they would rather spend writing. The other piece of it might be, depending on an author's goals, if an author is interested in pursuing traditional commercial publishing, let's say, an agent and that person's contacts within the business probably, are viewed by many as a valued asset and a reason to hire an agent. So I think, again, it's a business partner that you're really taking on. You're taking on somebody who is part of your team, and, they, I think, need to fulfill a business function for you and do it, in a way that advances your goals and satisfies you in order that having an agent makes sense. But I've always been one to say it's not something that's crucial, and many authors don't have an agent.
One of the things that you hear a lot going to conferences and listening to authors pitch to agents is, well, I don't like getting rejections. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, since you're the one that actually is rejecting the author in a sense, uh-huh. could you talk a bit about that?
That's a really, you know, I think that rejection is painful for people. You know, I think we can all look back at different times in our life where we were rejected. We saw ourselves being rejected for one reason or another. And, you know, I think depending on, you know, your age and the particular day you're in, it can be a really depressing experience. But what I would say is, both as somebody who, you know, in a sense, I submit material which is rejected. So, you know, I myself in my work as an agent have to learn how to think about and cope with rejection, and then for how authors should handle rejection. So I would say it's hard. And as an author, you know, I've had some writer friends for whom it was so difficult that it really became a problem for them to continue with their writing. But if your goal is to be a published writer, I think if you can almost train your brain to be very resilient and to be as neutral as possible, and somehow to think of both prospective agents and prospective editor publishers as your future partners in the publishing world, as people who are on your team. I always think if someone declines, she or he just isn't the right match or the right fit for the author's team. That's really how I've trained myself to think of it. You know, I think for me, I've been doing this for a long time, so I can accept a rejection with more equanimity. Certainly it's disappointing sometimes, but what I try to do, you know, when material is being declined, is to listen or, you know, solicit information that could be added value, you know, to my authors as we assess. So I think, you know, for me, part of my job is you know, sending material out, placing it on my author's behalf with publishers, and of course, not everybody is going to say yes every single time. I'm accustomed to that. I think for first-time authors, the best thing you can do while you have material out on offer to agents or to publishers is to move on to the next project you want to write and really immerse yourself in it, so that the thing that's engaging you the most is a new writing project, and hopefully the submission process with the inevitable rejections can then become more just a process that's happening to a project you've already completed. You know, I think we've all had the fun of listening to super successful authors speak, you know, from the podium at awards banquets, and, you know, a favorite ploy is to read rejection letters that they've received. And, you know, some of them are, you know, really just incredibly painful to hear, but of course in the reflected glow of success, it all, the sting goes away. But I think it goes to show that, you know, so many super successful writers collected, you know, copious numbers of rejection letters on the way to being successful.
Well, I was going to joke and say my work's perfect, so I've never gotten a rejection in my life. But
I've seen your office, and that's what the wallpaper is.
Exactly. One of the stereotypes, Meg, of that literary agent is if you do want one, they have to be from New York because you go to all these meetings with prospective editors. And I'm curious, is that stereotype still valid, especially with the world of the internet?
I don't think it is. Just because of what you said, you know, it's the world is so, you know, easily, we're so easily linked up And there are so many, you know, really excellent literary agents who aren't in New York, so I don't think it's necessary. I mean, some authors strongly prefer it. And, you know, I do think that New York is still the center of, you know, not completely, but most of the big five, you know, corporate headquarters are in New York. Most of the editors are in New York. You know, certainly that proximity makes it easier for someone in New York to, you know, see the players more frequently and more easily, perhaps, or, you know, have, you know, relationships, friendships outside of the office because we all live in the same town. But, you know, I think that, you know, there are a lot of West Coast agents whose projects, you know, are cool and fun, and people look forward to them coming to town to tell about what they're selling. You know, there are agents working from all over the place. So the short answer to your question is no, I don't think it's necessary to live in New York, although for me it's turned out to be the only place I want to be.
Okay, so now I have a two-fold question here. First one is, what's the number one rule that you would say would get somebody at least a look in your direction? When you would see something and be like, okay, I'll at least look at it, but then what's the number one rule for you to say, and you see it and say, yeah, I move it on?
I don't understand the second part of the question. Let me do it one piece at a time.
Okay.
The number one, it's not really a rule, but the number one way that material is facilitated, expedited, paid attention to, keenly anticipated even, is when another writer has referred it to me.
Oh.
It's just that simple, and it happens all the time, not just my own clients, but authors who know me, you know, from over the years, who know what I do, friends in publishing, you know, crazy things like, you know, your hairdresser's dog walker's second cousin. So, but I would say that the best leg up any prospective author or author looking for an agent could have would be a referral from a published author.
And then
but
on the flip side, then what's
your question?
So then on the flip side, what's the one thing that if they do is like almost like an automatic, you're not even looking at it? Like, do they send something? Is it something that they send or how they write a letter or how the book kind of comes to you? What's kind of the one thing that they would do where you would be like automatically barely even, you know, just pushing it aside because they did something like right off the bat before you could even get into the book, they already screwed it up?
Well, this is probably a pretty predictable answer, but for me, it would simply be that someone had sent me something that's way outside of my wheelhouse, and I think it's pretty easy for people to discern through research, which they should certainly do, you know, what a prospective agent's list looks like. Usually people have a profile. I mean, there are a lot of generalists, but, I mean, I'm really known for working with adult commercial fiction. So if somebody sent me a children's book, you know, it's a bummer. They just expended a lot of effort for something that's not going to go anywhere with me.
Yeah.
So I would say do your homework. Do it a lot. Spend a lot of time researching agents and try to have a dance card that really has been skillfully crafted of people who are your best prospective partners because their work aligns with their author list aligns with what you want to do.
And that's a great thing because they have to research, but you know, and is there some place that they would go, like a writer's house or not writer's house, but writer's market? Is that like the best place to go and then read the agent and see what they do and see if it fits with what you're writing?
I think Writer's Market is a good resource, but I think the two best resources are, one, books themselves. So, you know, if you're writing in a certain genre, you're probably reading a fair bit in that genre as well. And almost every book carries an acknowledgement to the agent. And it's just, it's such an easy thing to do to begin to, you know, kind of keep a list and say, oh, I love this author. I'd really, you know, I'd love to be, you know, in that channel. Oh, so-and-so is the agent. Oh, I see she's the agent for so-and-so also. So I'd say reading the actual books of authors and the ones you admire and identify with, it's so easy to find out who their agents are. And then two, just to put yourself in the company of published authors, you know, by either you read their work, you can write to them at their websites, you can connect with people on Facebook. There are millions of ways to do that. And I guess the third that people often successfully find agents by attending conventions and conferences. You know, agents are attending those because they're looking for new clients. So, you know, if you are a mystery writer, Thriller Fest, you know, with all the opportunities to pitch and so forth and so on, is great because the agents who are there are obviously people who are interested in mysteries. The same for perhaps a romance writers conference or an indie conference or, you know, anything you can identify. I think those are all good ways just to begin meeting agents and meeting writers who can say, oh, I think you'd like to know so-and-so. She might like your work. Or, oh, I can see you working with so-and-so. And just, you know, begin, as I said, to kind of amass names that you could then carefully winnow down.
I'm curious, since you've been an agent a while, how has the world of ocean...
Who said that? Was that
your you can't give her age up or something, Jess. You know, you can't do that. Going up to a woman and saying, are you pregnant? No, you don't say that.
Sorry. So you've been an agent for 3 or 4 years.
A couple of years.
I'm curious, how has the world of publishing changed, but yet remain the same?
Oh, well, you know, I think publishing always starts, it's all about the writers, and that will always remain the same. That never changes. It's all about creative artists who have something they want to tell the world. You know, in my part of it, it's always about storytelling. And then I think the other thing that never changes is our collective and almost primal urge to be told a story or to be transported by a story. So that kind of, to me, basic transaction, you know, writer to reader is always the same, always, always, always. How has publishing changed? I would say, you know, that's easy too. It's the, you know, the digital era has brought with it, you know, tremendous changes, tremendous opportunities, and, you know, I think a whole level of swiftness in our transactions that, you know, is very different from when I started. So I'd say digital is the big change, and writers and readers are the thing that never changes.
Well, has these changes made your job easier or more difficult?
This is breaking up a little. Can you say that again?
Wondering how these changes have made your job more difficult, or has it made it easier?
I would say mostly easier, you know, especially in terms of the alacrity with which, you know, certain processes can be completed, you know, contracts. I used to carry home manuscripts in a big bag every night, and my right shoulder will attest to that. It's ruined. I liked it.
No, I love the ebook now.
I really, really liked it. It was like catnip. I was carrying those big, heavy bags of paper because I thought, oh, there might be gold and then marhills. But, you know, now it's all on my reader, and it makes it really easy. You know, sometimes I still like to look at a paper manuscript, but really it's, you know, there is an ease of receiving and dispatching materials You know, it's super easy to send manuscripts overseas. It's just, I think that there has been a real streamlining, and that enables you to get a lot more done a lot more quickly.
Okay, so Meg, now it's funny story time. So you're going to have to share with us here, because I know you got probably 100, but when someone sat down to pitch in front of you, or maybe it was a letter that you received, what is one of the most memorable ones you can think of? And maybe not for the reasons because you bought the book, but you just, it's just memorable.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, let me tell you, this isn't a story about a book, but I'll try to think of one of those too, but I'll tell you what I always thought was a funny story about literary agents, because I grew up on an island and had a pretty sheltered growing up, but books were definitely like the number one thing for me, and I had a very vague idea that I wanted to work with books. And when I left the island and went to college, it was in a really small and remote town, but I made my way bravely from that town to Boston. And I thought, okay, now I'm going to begin my publishing career. But what I found out was that most of the companies in Boston, not all of them, were textbook companies. And it was really hard for me to figure a publisher. I think I was like the densest person on earth, because I just kept thinking, no, that's not really what I want to do. I really don't want to work with math textbooks. I really don't want to work with math textbooks. So finally, I decided to go to one of the publishing courses, and I went to the Denver publishing course. And part of what they do with these courses, I think, is to try to give publishing hopefuls a kind of big picture of the many things that you can do in publishing, because most of us go there with a vague, vague idea that being an editor would be nice, but we don't really even know what that is. So anyway, I'm at the Denver publishing course, and this beautiful woman walks onto the stage, and she is the literary agent. And I had never even heard of that job. I was really sheltered. And she kind of looked out at all of us wannabes, and she was just, she's like Glenda the Good Witch, and she said, "You know, some days my job is just to stay in bed and read." And I just remember, like, practically levitating and thinking, there's really a job where you do that?
Yeah. And sometimes you want to stay in bed after you read it because you're like, oh, my God, this is so bad, and now I have a headache.
Well, hopefully more of the other. But right. It just imprinted on me. I was dazzled by that idea. And I got really brave. The other thing that course did for me was it showed me that the kind of book publishing I was interested in was not in Boston, that I had to move to New York. A lot of trepidation on that front. But I told a friend. I got a job at a publishing company, and I always say this in the talks, you know, convention talks, but one aspect of my job was I had to answer fan mail for, this is a long time ago, a TV feline named Morris the Cat, who had written, quote-unquote, a book for the company, and got a lot of fan mail. So that was one of my jobs, answering the cat's
fan mail.
But anyway, I told a friend of mine there about this amazing job I had learned about being a literary agent, and I remember she came downstairs, and I was typing away one day, and she whispered in my ear, she said, "I heard about a job at a literary agency," and the rest is history. It was the place where I've worked since 1981. So I just love the story, though, of hearing somebody say, "Oh, you can just stay in bed and read all day." It was like, well, that's for me.
That's cool.
But you want a funny story about a book.
Well, yeah, maybe just, you know, maybe someone who came in front of you tried to pitch you a book, or, you know, you got a query letter or something, and it just sticks with you. You just, you know, maybe you hang that query letter on the wall, or you tell people, it's like, yeah, it's just funny. You know, just something funny, because I'm sure we all have them.
I know. Why am I so dull, and I can't think of that in the moment? Don't give me another question, or else I'm going to...
I had one where someone literally... When I was in Seattle last year at PNWA, somebody was trying to sell a book where, and Jeff knows this, where literally it was aliens that can control women's menstrual cycles.
Wow.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a speechless thing. But he was really trying to do that.
I can't
stop
that, John.
I'm like, and then you're just sitting there and you're like, what? And it was a guy. It wasn't even a girl. And it's like, what? I mean, there's nothing you can say to that. There's really nothing. You just got to look at him and say, you paid money to think of that. But the problem is, you literally wrote it down on a piece of paper, and you wrote, and you sat there and thought that was a good idea. It's like, wow. Well, yeah, that's what he was, an alien who said, and I'm sorry if he's listening, but you know, it was so bad. It was so bad it was funny, which is okay. You know, that still happens.
You know, it's amazing, though. I used to really live for reading query letters because there was that array of just amazingness. It was like a candy store, right?
Yeah.
You would see everything from, you know, well-thought-out, compelling ideas to exactly as you say, you know, aliens controlling various crazy things. And, you know, there were always the people, this is always just, everybody has this bugaboo, you know, that fatal query letter line, I am writing a fictional novel. That's like, oh, help.
Right.
But I can't think of anything funny in the moment. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
I'm a somber person.
I mean, the conversation, I mean, has been incredible, and we actually are out of time, and we could talk for hours because, you know, people love to hear this information. They love to hear the behind the scenes to really know, because I don't think people truly, if they've never really been published, especially younger people who never know what it was like when you said you started in 81 and you're doing your manuscript and you're going over to the drugstore, the library, and you're making 20 copies and paying for all of that and sending it all out. Now it's not like that anymore. So, you know, they don't understand what it was kind of like and maybe how things are. So it's great that you're able to kind of let them understand and let them know. So we can't thank you enough for giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you, Jeff Ayers. And I love your magazine, John, by the way. A lot of our authors have been in there. It's a terrific publication. So thank you both very, very much.
Thank you. You have a great one.
Thank you so much.
Good wishes, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. Of course, we've talked with you so many times, and it's great to have you back on to talk about now your 11th Cotton Malone book called The 14th Colony. So we're going to do 10 questions with Steve Berry this time, and let's just start with question number one. Tell us about The 14th Colony.
Well, it's a fascinating story that deals with a flaw in our Constitution, in the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, and into the 1947 Presidential Succession Act. It's a real flaw. They exist. These are flaws that Congress, for some reason, refuses to patch and refuses to fix. So I decided to exploit them in this novel. It also deals with something very interesting that happened in June of 1982 when Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II met alone in the Vatican for 50 minutes. To this day, we have no idea what they talked about. There's no record of it existing anywhere. They spoke totally alone by themselves. What we think happened is they made a deal that day that they would work independent of each other to take down the Soviet Union. And that's exactly what they did for the next 6 years. So the novel deals with those efforts. It also deals with two other things from the Cold War. We had the Soviet Union produced 250 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons. To this day, not a single one of those has ever been found. Soviet Union also had weapons caches hid all over the world. We know that because two of those have been found. They were booby-trapped when they were found, and there are many more that were never located. So you throw in the 20th Amendment, the presidential succession, the Cold War, Ronald Reagan, John Paul II, these suitcase-sized nukes that no one's ever seen, the weapons caches, and just for good measure, I added the oldest fraternal society in America called the Society of Cincinnati, which still exists to this day, and you put all that together and you get the 11th Cotton Malone Adventure.
And that's fascinating. And we're going to go into question two here, because it's how do you go about selecting the legends and the mysteries that surround history for the plot of your book? Is there a certain ingredient you look for that you want to make, that you want to explore further with Cotton?
Yeah, it needs to be something lost, something forgotten from the past, something we may not know a lot about, but I hope want to know more about, that still has relevance today, and that's really the kicker. It still has to be relevant today. Like in this book, this flaw in the Constitution from the 1940s and this Presidential Succession Act from the 1940s that has been around now for, you know, 70 years that Congress refuses to plug, made for perfect for me. So I look for those things from the past, those interesting things, because I want you to be interested in them too. And, you know, and the one thing about my novels, it's kind of a little niche I carved for myself, but about 90% of what's in the novel is true. I keep it as close to truth as I possibly can, as close to history as I possibly can. I do trip it up. I have to trip it up, that 10%, because I'm writing a piece of entertainment. But I have my writer's note in the back that tells you where I did that, so you'll be clear. So I try to keep the novels as tight as I can, and this book was fairly easy to do. It didn't take much for the little bit of tripping up I had to do. And all of these various elements, which may not sound like they go together, do. And the title, The 14th Colony, has great relevance because it deals with Canada, which was supposed to be our 14th colony, which figures in with all of these things.
Now, you mentioned the Society of Cincinnati, and of course, why a lot of people have at least heard about the Freemasons and the Illuminati and other secret societies, the Society of Cincinnati is just never mentioned in those groups.
Nope.
So what is it all about?
Well, it's a really interesting, it's a Revolutionary War society. It was created by officers who served in the Revolutionary War as a way to try to get their pay. They were not actually being paid when the war was over. They got to a point where they were going to revolt again. There was going to be a second American Revolution led by the army itself against the new government. But Washington stepped in and stopped it. And they created the Society of Cincinnati. It's still around today. It has one of the finest Revolutionary War libraries in the world. They are headquartered in Washington in a place called Anderson House, which is in the novel. Now, I give them a little more nefarious activities or a little more, I give them a little more things in their past that really were not there. But I decided it's a way to draw attention to them. They're basically today a philanthropic organization, and they do great work around the country. But, you know, they've never been in a novel before. You've never heard of them before. But they are the oldest fraternal society in America, and they are truly an American society.
So that expansion on them is part of that 10%.
That was part of the addition that I added in. But wasn't a whole lot that I had to do with that. It's just a little bit that I did with it. There was America's very first spy master, a man named Benjamin Talmadge, was a member of the society. He actually was. So it was that I could link it up pretty good, and then I tied them all in with this whole concept of the 14th colony.
Now, the question for... So when you go into a book with questions, do you find the answers you're looking for, or do you just find more questions?
A little of both. Actually, both. If I don't find answers, I'm wasting time, so I've got to find some answers. But always, inevitably, more questions are raised up, and I have come across those. And some of those questions are irrelevant and mean nothing, and I ignore them. A lot of them, though, aren't, and they raise plot questions and other things. And that's why I have to do my own research myself, because I'm the only one who can actually discover all of that stuff, because I'm the only one who knows where I'm going.
And now, question five, I have to admit, when I first saw the title, The 14th Colony, I was thinking that this could be like Roanoke. But, you know, people love to learn about conspiracy theories and hear about legends of hidden treasures. So was there like a mystery early on that intrigued you that you wanted to start writing about historical fiction?
No, I just loved all things from the past that are kind of forgotten and kind of lost. I've always been a fan of those. And in this book, you know, it fascinated me that, and I didn't know this till I started researching the novel, that we wanted Canada. We wanted Canada to be our 14th colony. We invaded Canada in 1775. We invaded Canada again in 1815. Both times we were were defeated. It's the only country in the world that has defeated America twice on the battlefield. We wanted it so bad that in the 1930s, there was a secret invasion plan created to actually invade Canada. We not only created the plan, we actually did preparations for it. And if Hitler had taken Britain in the Battle of Britain, we would have invaded Canada and taken control of it. That was part of the plan. Part of the plan also was they weren't going to give it back either. And once they took it, they were going to keep it. That plan remained classified until 1974, which was fascinating. And all of that is dealt with in the novel.
Wow. So, question six now. Now with 11 Cotton Malone books, and you're able to kind of look back at the start of the series, which was the Templar legacy, if people wanted to know that, how has Cotton grown as a character?
He's grown quite a bit, actually, and a lot of that's responsible for my wife, Elizabeth. She wants more emotion into Cotton. She wants more feelings into Cotton. And they have been there, by the way. They're much more in there. In the Charlemagne Pursuit, Cotton did two things I thought he would never do in any novel. He had sex with someone, and he cried. You know, which I never thought either one of those would happen, but they did, and they were poignant, and they were relevant to the novel. I don't have any sex in the books at all, but it was all staged. But he still did, which I never thought I would even imply that. Cotton has changed a lot over the last 10 years. He's become much more introspective. He's become a lot more feeling and emotion in him. He's recognized that he's in love. It bothers him sometimes. He's not comfortable with that. He's trying to deal with it. He's dealt with his son and the problems with that. So, the Cotton Malone from the Templar Legacy is a different Cotton Malone from the 14th Colony. And I suspect he will continue to grow.
And that's what keeps the series fresh, and not just the mystery, but keeps the characters fresh and keeps your writing fresh and keeps you fresh by seeing the evolve, by seeing the evolution of Cotton and the other characters grow.
Yeah, and that, you've got to do that. I mean, you can't just keep writing the same thing over and over again. I mean,
right.
The characters have to develop. The characters have to evolve. They have to have, new things. But you have to do it over slowly. You can't go too radical with it because, I don't write the books where you have to read them in any order. You're not required.
Right.
You can read my series backwards and you'd be fine. So you've got to be careful about that you don't go too far with each novel.
So now question seven, what challenges do you still encounter with each new novel that you sit down to write?
Trying to do something new and different each time. I mean, David Morrell taught me that years ago. He said, make sure you do something innovative every time you write a novel, something you've never done before. And in the 14th Colony, that came with the length of it. It's one of the longest novels I've ever written. But I added an element to it that I've never done before. Something new was a ticking clock. There's a clock ticking down in this novel to 12 noon on January 20th, and Cotton has to race this clock. And I've never had a ticking clock before in one of the thrillers. So it was a longer book for me, and it had the ticking clock. And the ticking clock, you don't realize the book does have the length to it because there's so much happening so fast with this clock ticking down. So for me, it's trying to do something new and different with each novel, and I do that with each one. I set a goal with each one of something new and different.
And just to clarify, January 20th at noon is when the presidential inauguration every 4 years takes place, and that's where the climax comes to a head.
Yes, what happens, yeah. So the Constitution says that at 12 noon on January 20th, the term of the current president ends. That's what it says. It doesn't say the new one starts. It says the term of the current president ends. So the new one who's just been elected, or if not there for some reason, the person who falls into line will be sworn into office at 12 noon on January 20th. It's that's the magic moment of which power is transitioned. But there's a fascinating flaw in the law. What happens if the president-elect and the vice president-elect both die before taking the oath? Well, I can tell you now, it's chaos.
And that's the fun part, isn't it?
Yeah, it's political chaos. It's legal chaos. And this is one of the flaws Congress has refused to plug.
So now, question 8. In the 14th colony, what new character surprised you by having a larger voice than you thought they would on the outset?
You mean in this novel?
Yes.
In this novel, well, you would always have to say the antagonist of the book, comes into play. But the character that it kind of drew me was the female Navy character that I created, Sue Bayon. And she's an interesting character, Sue is. And she's a Riverine, which, was a division of the Navy that deals with fighting on rivers. It was the most, it had more casualties in that division of the military than any other in Vietnam, was the Riverines. And they just recently allowed women in, so I made her one of those. And she was a fascinating, fun character. She began to kind of dominate the scenes when she was in them. And her and Luke have some very interesting interactions in this book. And you never know, you may see her again.
And, and the reason why I always kind of like to ask that question is because I think a lot of readers and fans might assume that you kind of already have things clocked out before you start writing it. But in essence, sometimes these characters speak, and you give them a larger voice, and that's a surprise to me as an author.
I had it plotted out. I knew what she was going to be, but as she came alive, she was fun. And she was fun to interact, and she was interesting to deal with, and she'd actually make a great character all by herself to go with. So I filed her away. She did not die in the book. She's still around. You never know. You might see her again one day.
Now, question 9, this is going to be a guess for me, and I'm just going to kind of guess this, because, you've dealt with North Korea, and now with the rise of Putin and Russia, the Cold War is starting to kind of be talked about more, because maybe 15 years ago, Russia and the Cold War, people weren't really talking about it anymore, because Russia was in such disarray. So I'm just trying to say, is this, because of what's going on today, was that one of the reasons why Russia and the KGB was fixed as the centerpiece for the 14th colony?
That was part of that reason. Part of it, definitely, the topic is hot. So I definitely gravitated there, but I mainly picked it for the presidential aspect of it, because I knew this was a presidential year, and I came up with the idea for this novel several years ago, and I filed it away and said I'm going to hold it and use it for 2016. So I specifically wanted to deal with inauguration. I wanted Danny Daniels, my fictional president's term, to end, and I wanted to deal with how that would happen, and I wanted to do it in a presidential election year where this subject matters on everyone's mind. So it was all fairly intentional, yes.
And boy, do we not have chaos in this presidential election already, huh?
I didn't know that when I picked the idea. But with it's kind of interesting with that all that's going on. I mean, the book raises some questions, and so hopefully there'll be a connection there, and people will enjoy reading this.
And so the last question, of course, people always like to know, what's going to be next for Todd?
Well, it's interesting. I finished it. It's turned in. It'll be published next April, and April 17. It's called The Lost Order. It deals with a very fascinating mystery from the Smithsonian. I've been wanting to use the Smithsonian in a novel for a very long time. I serve on the Smithsonian Libraries Board, so I deal with the Smithsonian quite a bit, and I've been wanting to incorporate it. And this is a really cool adventure that Cotton gets caught up in from the Civil War. What you're going to learn in this novel, which makes it new and different, is you're going to learn how Cotton got his name. Finally
going to
learn the story.
Ah, there you go. So
and I always say, long story. Well, it was. It took a whole book. And so you're going to learn all about that. But the 14th Colony is my take on the spy novel. It's all the old spy novel. This is my take on it. The Lost Order is my take on the adventure novel, the action adventure novel. So there's a lot of action adventure in it with the Smithsonian. 90% of it is real. I think people are going to be fascinated by some of the stuff they're going to learn about the Smithsonian. Not the kind of hokey stuff or whatever, but the real secrets that are up there. And Cotton gets caught up in something quite fascinating.
Well, Steve, as always, wish you nothing but the best. The 14th Colony is, it's a winner. got to tell everybody. I mean, it's a winner. So we want to thank you so much for joining us, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me, John.
All right. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you go, everybody. Meg Ruley and Steve Barry here on Beyond the Cover. Jeff, great interviews. Great interviews.
Well, I hope everybody liked both of those. And Steve, I got to say to Steve, I would hope that Cotton Malone does something interesting. Otherwise, it's like, no, he's going to sit on the couch for the next one. I'm like, no, Steve, no.
Yeah. He's relaxing. He's just taking it easy this time, and that's just what he's going to do, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to have a root beer and just, yeah, kick back.
Mm-hmm. So we've been saying everybody May 2nd, and of course, people that have known Jeff and I have listened to the show now for over a year. We've been doing this, a year and 4 months.
Oh my goodness. We
like to have some debates. We've never really had this debate before. We've talked about off the air and how we're going to do it. So what we decided to do was, and we kind of went, and it's, again, it's going to be Star Wars versus Star Trek, but it's not going to be the books or this. It's the universe versus one universe. It's like, which universe kind of has captivated society and kind of which one is basically almost the more interesting one, you know, with the characters and the setup. And I know that Star Trek has more visuals to go off of. Star Wars has probably more written stuff to go off of. Would you agree, Jeff?
No.
Okay, fuck off. So, but Star Trek
Star Trek has TV shows.
I mean, you guys, Star Trek has a lot more visual. A lot more visual stuff. Star Wars got 7 movies. Let's face it. Now they have Clone Wars.
Right.
They have some animated stuff.
Right.
But Star Trek's got, what do you have? You have Star Trek, you have Voyager, you have Deep Space Nine, you have Next Generation, plus you have, was it 7 movies, or and then the 2 new ones?
Well, you forgot Enterprise, too, but yes.
Yeah.
It's been,
so you have a lot more visual to go off of.
Yeah.
But Star Wars has more of an expanded universe, I think.
Star Trek has over 800 novels that have been published over the last almost 50 years.
Okay, right, but your universe is still, I don't think, as diverse as Star Wars is in the way of Star Wars not only taps into, of course, things that are outside of the Earth. I mean, because there's nothing really about this world, but the Enterprise is about America, and it's about kind of this world. Star Wars does not reference Earth. It is a, you know, it's a galaxy with beyond. It's a world. It's a totally open world where Star Trek is set pretty much here in the United States, and then they sent them out to go search for things. Where Star Wars, it's much different that way. It's not set like that.
Well, Star Wars tells you it's the past, and Star Trek is our future.
But Star Wars goes back 20,000 years before, or is it 5,000 years, I think, or so, before the original Star Wars came out. The one thing you can't deny, though, the Star Wars movies are much better than the Star Trek movies.
Well, it depends on which movies you're talking about.
I'm talking, if you put all 7 in a row, if you take just the 7 Star Wars movies, and then you pit them up against Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, The Undiscovered Territory, or whatever that was called, and you put those movies up against Star Wars is much better. Star Wars is a much more religious. There's religious aspects of it. There's a lot of Buddhism things that go on in Star Wars. I think that the characters have a lot of depth. But, you know, this is going to be the debate. This is what we're going to get into.
Yes. In all honesty, when we say debate, the truth is you and I both like them both. I mean, I will say, yeah, I like Star Wars. I thought the new movie was a lot of fun, and it was nice for them to actually go back and make a movie that I could admit to liking for a change. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could say about Star Trek as well, the last couple Next Generation movies were not great. And the two that J.J. Abrams did they have their pros and cons of each.
I thought
based
that,
on what
I
I'm hearing
say,
about the new movie, I'm scared.
Oh, really? I don't know about that one. I thought that the two that he did, and again, I did not immerse myself in Star Trek like I did Star Wars, which is why I'm on the Star Wars side. I thought that for what they were, for me, they were entertaining, and I thought that they were good. I don't know, and you guys are going to school me probably on some of those differences that J.J. Abrams fucked up on, but the one thing that we do have is J.J. Abrams is in both worlds.
That's true.
So that's going to be
yep,
something interesting to talk about.
That is true. That's very true.
You know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think the thing about Star Wars is I think it's a lot – for my view, I think it's more popular because it's more of a crossover. I think that a lot more maybe house moms would know more about, you know, who Luke Skywalker and those types of people are more than they would know. Now, I think that a lot of people do know William Shatner and they know Leonard Nimoy, but I don't think that they know Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Next Generation. I think the casual fans know the original, but they don't know the rest. But I think a lot of people know the Star Wars world because it's been around since 77, and there's so much hype about it. There's always a bunch of hype. There's always a bunch of stuff that goes on that I think that there are more household names, Han Solo, Princess Leia, Chewbacca. The household names are a lot more prevalent in Star Wars than Star Trek. But these, again, are what we're going to get into.
I'd have to sort of disagree with you again. Everybody knows who Mr. Spock is. Everybody
sure.
knows Captain Kirk. Everybody, you
sure.
know, will pretend to be, you know, talking like this, you know, sort of thing. But
sure. But
yeah,
one thing Star Wars has that Star Trek does not have, and it trumps it all. And you cannot deny, the greatest villain ever is fucking Darth Vader. You can say Khan is a great villain in Star Trek, but if you put up a face of Khan and a face of Vader, and you tell 100 people, 100 people know Darth Vader, how many people are going to know who Khan is?
Yeah, that's a good point. And Darth Vader is a great villain, but is he really a villain by the time it's all over?
Yes, he's a villain. He's a ruthless bastard.
Even when he's redeemed?
Well, yes, because the millions, just because, I mean, that would be like saying, oh, well, Hitler on his deathbed accepted Jesus Christ or whatever, and now is he a good guy now? No, he still killed millions of freaking people. I mean, Darth Vader
right.
was the ultimate ruthless villain. He sat and watched a planet get blown up with his daughter standing next to him.
Yeah, and he didn't even know it was his daughter.
Right. So, and we'll talk about some flaws,
I don't think
too,
Lucas
because there are some flaws in both. Yeah, there's some flaws
yeah.
in both. But that's kind of the stuff we get. We're going to get deep into it. It's going to be great to have Chris. It's going to be great to have Greg to be able to bounce these ideas off of and see their depth of their and how they are. And you just kind of have a nice discussion of both worlds because these are the biggest science fiction, fantasy, I guess, fantasy a little, more science fiction than anything ever created, without a doubt, and everybody knows it. They've touched everybody's lives. Most everybody's probably seen one or multiple movies from both things, or a TV show or something, and mm-hmm. the stories included in both of them are unparalleled and unmatched, without a doubt.
Absolutely. And honestly, I think we're going to come away with a love and respect for both franchises when this is all over.
Yeah,
even
and
more
hopefully
so.
People will, and hopefully we can have the fans learn something new and a little more in depth. But well, we got about 45 seconds before we got to end this, Jeff. So it's always a pleasure, dude.
You should if you're listening to us right now, if you've got questions you want us to ask during the show, contact us.
Radio@suspensemagazine.com. Radio@suspensemagazine.com. Email us any questions or anything you have. Remember, this will be airing live on Monday, May 2nd, 7:30 Pacific time. So until then, Jeff, it's always a pleasure.
All right,
dude.
Looking
we'll
forward to
see you
it.
Next week.
All right.
All right. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.